my first question is, do you own a fishing boat? And then the quick answer is yes. And then I say, well, you're going to have to sell it. Meaning, you know, you're going to work all summer.
Yeah. And it's not easy money at all. I don't know any organic farmer that cashes a grain check or a livestock check and says, boy, that was easy money. People earn it.
Welcome to the 355th installment of Ear to the Ground, the Land Stewardship Project's podcast on family farming, regenerative agriculture, community food systems, and local democracy. I'm Brian DeVore, editor of the Land Stewardship Letter. During a recent field day on his farm, Matthew Fitzgerald made what he calls the big reveal. That consisted of the young farmer spinning around a giant whiteboard located in his machine shed to reveal a color-coded, detailed schedule for field work during the 2024 growing season. This is what being an organic farm looks like, Matthew quipped. He calls the chart his farm flow, and it's proven to be an invaluable tool for successfully growing crops without chemicals in central Minnesota. Matthew, along with his father, Joe, were hosting the August field day for other farmers, as well as lenders and folks involved with the marketing end of organic farming. There was also a presentation on how to utilize and modify the various field implements needed to get through an organic growing season. In short, the field day, which was sponsored by Organic Agronomy Training Service, Grain Millers, the University of Minnesota's Forever Green Initiative, and the Minnesota Office for Soil Health, was focused on providing a comprehensive view of the opportunities and challenges associated with organic crop production. The Fitzgerald Farm was a fitting venue for such a field day. Joe's been raising organic crops since 1994, and after graduating from college and working off the farm for a few years, Matthew, who's 33, joined the operation. The Fitzgerald family raises around 2,700 acres of certified organic corn, soybeans, wheat, peas, and edible bean crops. They farm the flat, fertile fields near Glencoe in Minnesota's McLeod County. After a panel of farmers shared their experiences with marketing, and a mini-tour of the various specialty weed control implements used by the Fitzgeralds was given, it was clear that, indeed, organic producers earn every cent of that premium they get. In addition, a field-side discussion about the balancing act organic crop farmers must strike between controlling weeds with tillage and maintaining soil health drove home why Matthew requires a detailed scheduler to get through the long days of spring and summer and attain a successful harvest. After the field day, the father-son team, which refers to their operation as a 1.5-generation farm, sat down to talk to me about what first drew them to organic and how, rather than silver bullet solutions, they rely on silver buckshot to overcome pests, climate change, and marketing challenges. It's clear the Fitzgeralds are committed to organic production, despite the fact that spending time on the lake is not an option during the summer. Matthew started our conversation describing how his farm flow scheduler provides a visual guide to what work needs to be done when. It can also help remind the farmers why they feel pretty tired by the end of the growing season.
What we use is a visual tool to lay out our work. And what it is sort of it's stolen from the project management world. So it's called a Kanban board. Would be the, if you were like a really corporate process person, that would make sense. But okay. For all of us lay people, basically it's just a chart of everything that happens on the farm, laid out with little colorized dots. Each dot represents a day and a thing that we're doing on the farm. Okay. And so that was a tool that we started developing 2 years ago to kind of help us start our mornings and go, okay, what's happening in the chaos? Because in June, it's chaos.
Yeah.
And so that really became what we're calling farm flow, sort of the concept. And it's really worked. And basically, the whole team uses it. We stand up, talk about what's happening, challenges, what's going well, what's not. Maybe a piece of equipment's broken that we can't use. Maybe it's about to rain and we need to prioritize something. So it's really a visual way to represent the work that we're doing on a day-to-day basis. Stepping back after having gone through a weeding season, it's like, oh, wow, that's why I'm tired. Because it looks like scattershot of colors, you know, yeah, of all the work that we've done. And it's hard to see that in the middle of it. So the big reveal today was sort of this dramatic zoom back retrospect look. But when we're in the actual growing season, we're just filling it in one day at a time. Uh-huh.
And what are the different color, like what are the cover different colors represent?
So the, each color represents kind of a weed control activity. So we've got a color for tine weeding, a color for rotary hoeing, flame weeding, weed zapping. So each kind of activity that we do, and so there's probably about 8 or 9 different icons that we use, and they repeat over this over each field and across different crops.
And then do you kind of note somehow what the weather was like that it was rainy certain days, that kind of thing?
Let's not overstate how complicated this thing is. It's a whiteboard.
It's a
whiteboard with the dry erase marker. So we just write how much it rained that day. So we're working on actually turning it into a digital tool. So we're working, I have a grant from the Schmidt Foundation and Mad Agriculture to turn it into a tool, because this all started with I have a friend who's a data scientist. So we crunch numbers on our farm with the core question of, like, what gives us the best yields on our farm? So we looked at every variable we could think of, like rainfall, crop rotation, variety, previous crop, fertility, soil suitability rating. The number one indicator for yield was the frequency of passes. Said differently, the more often that you're weeding your garden, the better your tomatoes are. Not a rocket science conclusion, but what we found is that we weren't executing well on our farm. We weren't getting those passes done. Maybe a piece of equipment broke down, or it rained, or whatever deviation occurred. Yeah. So if we could visualize the work we were doing, it would help us execute better. Yeah. And so that was the core concept. Now we're turning it into a tool to do that with a team, have standard operating procedures behind it, track the weather digitally so we don't have to transcribe it, and then hopefully generate reports, so making organic certification easier. Mm. So we're doing that with open source code. So for those techie farmers that want to do it themselves, that'll be available.
Very cool. That's a great idea. And it, like you said, it also helps you put in context what the season was like a little bit, to stand back and look at that, I would think.
It's been a tough year. And so, like, when we've been like, why do I feel so tired? And why does this field look so bad? Being able to look back and say, oh, it's the rainiest April, May, June record, and here's what it looks like on our farm. It's a reminder why.
And you were talking about the team. You have, is it 2 employees or?
So we're kind of a team of 6 during the season. Okay. So two owners, Matthew and Joe. We have a full-time young guy, Evan, American. We've got 4 H-2As, so it's a foreign visa worker program. Mm-hmm. We've got a great group of guys from South Africa that work for us. And then we have a couple of retired part-time farmers that also help out seasonally.
Yeah. Joe, is that something you would have found useful when you were getting started and in transitioning into organics?
Yes. I've been farming organically since 94. Mm-hmm. And what the farm flow chart gives us is a visual of gaps. And I might want to hit everything perfectly, but when I can look at the graph every morning, I realize, oh, there's a space, and it's a space of number of days in between a particular practice on a particular field. And I can very quickly realize I need to do something at that field today. For anybody that's visual, and I think many or most people are, it's a helpful reminder to get things done in a timely fashion and keep track of it.
That leads me to my other question, which was, we looked at your equipment, and we also looked at one of your soybean fields, and Dr. Anna Cates, who's a soil health expert from the U of M, talked a little bit about soil health. But one of the things that struck me was, for an organic operation like this, it is so key for you to be able to track what worked, what didn't, and kind of look at that big picture, because one thing I think you were talking about was, you're not using the same equipment in the same fields every year the same way. And so you have to sometimes plan your rotation based on, well, what kind of equipment am I going to be using in that field the next, because, for example, with the tine weeder here, I think you were talking about, well, if there's going to be corn in that field, it's basically a dump loader because it's going to be collecting. But can you talk a little bit about how important that is a little bit?
Yeah, so I think the tools that we use on our farm are pretty specialized, and so they're sequenced.
Yeah.
And so specific to the tine weeder, it's a dense harrow, and so basically it's going to be really effective at uprooting weeds. Mm-hmm. Or at weeds. It's also going to be really effective at collecting debris.
Yeah.
And so if we're coming off of a corn crop, we'll have a lot of debris from that corn crop in the previous year.
Mm-hmm.
So we may be unable to use that tine weeder if we've got too much debris, and so we have to think about our tillage that preceding year. If we're going to plan to use a tine weeder, we need to be either more aggressive with our tillage, or be mindful if we're going to use a cover crop that we're managing the residue from that cover crop.
Oh.
3-dimension trust. Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's a good way to put it. So speaking of soil health, one of the things we were talking about out there, which is kind of that age-old, as Dr. Cates put, push-pull of balancing. If you're going to be using, if you're going to be conventional and you're using chemicals, you're kind of doing a biological disturbance of that soil. If you're doing organics, you're building your biology and you're not disturbing it biologically, but you are disturbing it a fair amount structurally.
It's a trade-off that we know that undisturbed soil has a certain vitality, and when we disturb it out of necessity for weed control, there's a certain cost to that. I think some of the crop rotation, the utilization of manure, cover crops, those systems in organic, especially organic, but conventional people can do that too. That helps offset some of the negatives of tillage. But I would say we're always trying to figure out improvements. And so can we till differently? Can we till better? Can we change our rotation so that our net gain in soil health is positive?
Yeah, I think that's a good point, and that you're, and Tom Conner talks about this a lot, and I've been to his field days too, where in the short term he may be doing some harm, quote unquote, but he looks at it multiple years down the road. Is he building that soil resiliency kind of in the long term?
Yeah, it's also like, I think it's easy to think of life in binaries, good, bad, black, white, and most things are gray, and agriculture really is gray. You know, and fundamentally, it's an extractive endeavor. And so, good, bad, you know, I'm part of a group called the Climate Land Leaders, which is a group of landowners, more so than farmers, that are thinking about stewardship and a long-term framework for climate change. It's one of the tensions that I find in that group is a lot of them are inclined to do a no-till management system, but they're heavily reliant on atrazine and synthetic inputs that are actually like a much more significant carbon impact on the environment. All these things are trade-offs all the time. And in our context, our conventional neighbors are tilling the same as we are in terms of aggressive deep tillage in the fall. And so it's not as though our neighbors, at least in our like central Minnesota context, I can't think of a single no-till farmer in our county. So it's not as though they're doing better than we are, you know, like, so I think I'm careful to like, I think it all exists on a spectrum.
Yeah. Speaking of climate change, I'm glad you brought that up. It must make it, I mean, we've seen the two extremes. It must make it much more difficult. The past years, you've really seen that struggle. And I think you had talked about, Matthew, this idea that for organic farmers, it's even more because timing is so key. You can't just come in with maybe, well, let's talk about it. I like this kind of the way you describe it. The conventional farmer has a couple big hammers they can use. You have a lot of little hammers, but those little hammers rely on really good timing.
Right. We're really on the front lines of climate change as organic farmers. We're much more vulnerable to those swings. We don't have the same cover-up tools.
but talk about this hammer. I like this idea of the little hammers, and several little hammers, and then the commission will have more access to a couple big hammers that they can kind of come in.
Right. I think that's an idea. We should credit Sam Oswald for that. Yeah, I think we think about our weed management as a system, you know, these little tools that we're applying sequentially and sort of an art form approach to get the results that a single you know, herbicide pass would do.
And we looked at a soybean field, and the way you described it was, I thought it looked pretty good. It's got a little bit of weed issues, but you said, well, this is an example of in a wet year like this, there was just a lot of little hammers we didn't have access to in a situation like that.
Yep. Yeah, it's certainly not our prettiest field, but I think that's probably the most honest field day you can have.
I think it was really good that we looked at equipment because one of the things I think where you're trying to strike that balance of maybe reducing cultivation or using soil disturbance and keeping that soil intact is you're using techniques like flame weeding and the weed zapper with the electrical system. Those seem like that's a good example of we are seeing more of these innovations that can maybe help strike that balance. I know some people have worked with roller crimping. That's another way. Not get swept up on the latest thing and just as a hot trend that isn't really working, but you really have to pay attention to how is this going to fit into my system a little bit.
Yeah, as a weed zapper as an example, we had a neighbor weed zap for us for a couple of years. We had some custom hiring done for a few years. So we're cautious to jump into anything too quickly ourselves. And I think no silver bullet, maybe silver buckshot. It's just going to be little pieces.
I would say the technology available to us, the innovations, doesn't even have to be technology. Clever tools that are available are a result of American innovation, a lot of European components based on their experience. I'd have to say the tools that we have available to us and other organic farmers is more diverse, more sophisticated, more effective now than it certainly was 30 years ago when I began.
Give me an idea of your, what is your rotation? What is your general rotation that you're using right now? Or,
you know, starting out in transition, we would probably be first year dry yellow peas, harvest those peas, seed a winter wheat that would overwinter, harvest that winter wheat, apply a cover crop plus some manure, cover crop overwinters, roll into corn, soybeans, then maybe another corn crop, then maybe a small grain crop or an edible bean crop or something.
Like you said, that diversity really does over time.
Yep.
Helps really build that. We had a nice panel discussion of marketing, and that organics has, there's many more options than there used to be. And I heard I was sitting at lunch with some folks who were talking about the old days when they would send a truck off and they didn't know if they were ever going to see their check again, you know, things like that. But it's gotten a lot better. But one of the points, really good point you made was it is still a little difficult in that there's not really a futures market where you can do price discovery and all that. Can you talk a little bit about some of the challenges that kind of still remain in organics right now?
Yeah, I think a new organic farmer would struggle because so much of it is relationships still, that they wouldn't necessarily know who are the good buyers and bad buyers, because there still are good buyers and bad buyers. There are still people that won't pay or have some shady practices. And unless you have that experience, you're not going to know. And that also translates to, you know, the contracting terms. You know, are they pricing you or not? And generally, there's going to be a little bit of a premium within a premium if you have a relationship, meaning like you've sold to this buyer many times. Mm-hmm. There's a relationship there. They feel like you're going to be able to produce what you say you're going to be able to produce. The quality is what you're going to say you're going to be able to do. And that goes two ways, because we've also had relationships where the buyer's going to be a little bit more lenient. Your moisture, instead of 15% is 16%. Instead of rejecting it, they're going to accept that slightly higher moisture. You know, and that only happens through this sort of back and forth type relationship. And that's difficult if you're starting from zero.
Yeah, so that relationship, that really came through. Folks were talking about how important that relationship is, even more so than in, where you can just take it to the elevator for conventional, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, I think Matthew's description of the relationships being important in marketing is also a hallmark of organics, that it's a friendly network. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily competitive, that there's a great deal of information sharing, including what are you getting paid for your crop? How do you market it? Which would be countercultural for much of agriculture. Organic farmers aren't necessarily more virtuous, but it's just a friendly network where there's a lot of cooperation.
I guess this is a question about advice for other folks, and you had a great thing where you said people will call you sometimes. Could you tell me, when people call you for, say, yeah, I'm thinking about going organic, and the first thing you ask them a very important question, and I think that is a good question. So can you tell us what you ask them?
This is a question asked in the land of 10,000 lakes, so let's give it some context, too, for our listeners in Iowa that are not so blessed. My first question is, do you own a fishing boat? And then the quick answer is yes, and then I say, well, you're going to have to sell it. Meaning, you know, you're going to work all summer.
Yeah, I think that's, and this is a prime example, and you're constantly plant, like that flow chart, not flow chart, what do you call it?
Farm flow.
I like that. You're going to trade that mark that, aren't you? Yeah, the farm flow shows that you really are going to have to, and I think you said you're better off buying an ice house to go ice fishing. But do you have any other advice that's maybe a little more specific? Isn't going to just get them to hang up the phone and go, oh my gosh, I'm never going to do this again.
Yeah, really, the counter to the friendly part about organics is, I would say the mentorship is critical. And to point to organizations like Marble Seed and the USDA program and LSP and others that are doing that's, you're not going to be able to learn everything from a single field day or a single conference attendance. That each year is so different that it takes years to learn the process. And so having a mentor that's in your context, either the same cropping, the same geographic, the same soil type, that is going to be critical for anybody's success. And that's been part of our success, is we've had mentors, we've had friends, we've had people that have helped us.
I certainly saw that today. Boy, I think the lunch is sometimes the most important part of these field days, because folks are getting together and sharing information. And some people knew each other, but some had never heard of each other. And so, yeah, it was really good to see that farmer-to-farmer networking. One of the things I wanted to ask you about, Joe, is that, and you know, but you said you've been organic since 90, you've been doing organic since 94. So that's, you know, that's pretty early in the movement. It was before we had a national standard and all of that. I guess I'd like to ask you more about what you saw in organics, if you were, you know, and you were, so you're probably like me a little bit of someone who came through the farm crisis, saw the results of that. What was it about organics specifically that really you saw that was maybe the future, and you've been able to prove it here, you know, we're several years down the road here now?
Well, part of my background is studying theology in graduate school, and people come to their faith story through all sorts of ways. The religious community, Catholic, Protestant, the institutions, the congregations, the individuals, were very much involved in the farm crisis in the 80s, helping to call out the problem, helping to support people that were really struggling through those very difficult years, and also calling for solutions to preserve the family farm, to heal the environment. Out of that time, there was a renewed interest in environmentally friendly farming. There were private and government programs that took on women's names. There was LISA, Low Input Sustainable Agriculture. There was SARA, Sustainable Agriculture Research, Association or Education. So sort of the society was wrestling with what's the future look like. And organic agriculture has been around for a long time. Europe, of course, has had a richer history than the U.S., but there's a lot of experience there. And out of that time, organics really started to get a foothold here in the U.S. People approached it for philosophical reasons, faith reasons, economic reasons, and the economic premium was not as great in the early days as it is now. And it's not easy money at all. I don't know any organic farmer that cashes a grain check or livestock check and says, boy, that was easy money. People earn it, but it's more of a developed network, a developed economy now. So for ourselves, we say we're in organics for philosophical and economic reasons.
Looking down the road now 30 years, it must be pretty satisfying to see a son of yours kind of transitioning into this.
We began this farm out of my wife's and my love of farming and rural and agriculture and the environment. We don't have a multi-generation farm that we have to find somebody within the family to continue. No, our kids grew up in the farm. They learned all the wonderful responsibilities and lessons within farming, but we had no expectation that our son or daughter would necessarily go into agriculture. That was our gig, and it's been a good life. So it's wonderful to see people of all ages, but especially young people, to get involved and offer important leadership for agriculture, and in this case, organic agriculture.
It is that whole thing of, is this going to be a one-off thing? But you, like you said, it was, you got this thing started. You weren't super tied into, since it wasn't something you had inherited from family, you didn't feel that responsibility maybe to continue it, but now it is, like Matthew said, it's kind of 1.5 generation kind of thing, generational farm. It is, yeah, you've been able to kind of, it seems like you're working well together and you've got this team going. And there were some young farmers here today who don't have a whole lot of, there was people who have a lot of experience, some that don't have so much experience and are just looking into it. And I think that's a sign that they see a future maybe for something like this. That's kind of exciting, I think.
It's very exciting. It's hope for the future. And I'm delighted for the industry of clean food, healthy food, organic food. People are interested in what they're eating and what their food system is looking like.
more on organic crop production, see the podcast page for Ear to the Ground episode 355 at landstewardshipproject.org. If you have comments or suggestions about this podcast, contact Brian DeVore at bdevore@landstewardshipproject.org, or you can call 612-816-9342. It helps us greatly if you can give Ear to the Ground a rating on whatever podcast platform you utilize. And word of mouth is the best way to spread the news about our podcast. If you like what you hear, tell at least one person about LSP's Ear to the Ground. Thanks to Laura Borgendale, Western Minnesota musician, for Ear to the Ground's theme music. And a special thank you to all of Land Stewardship Project's members who make initiatives such as this podcast possible. If you're not a member, visit landstewardshipproject.org to learn how you can support LSP. Speaking of the value of LSP membership, Joe Fitzgerald shares a long history with the Land Stewardship Project. At the end of our interview, he wanted to share these thoughts as LSP wraps up its 42nd year of working to keep the land and people together.
I'm grateful for the really over four decades worth of Land Stewardship Project's leadership here in the Upper Midwest and in Minnesota in particular. And my own roots with LSP go back many decades. The organization that I headed up many years ago was a fiscal agent for LSP when it began. I served on the board for a number of years. I've been delighted and proud of what LSP has done for Minnesota and the Upper Midwest, and really in on many national issues as well. It continues to exert leadership and creativity for improving communities.
We appreciate those kind words, Joe. LSP couldn't do it without committed members such as yourself. And to all of you out there, thanks for listening.